Right now on Amplified, we're about to find out how seemingly impossible things are eminently possible.
He never let perfection hinder progress. And so I just say, okay, let's just make progress. I have to be consciously aware of thinking, oh God, we signed a contract to do something. Like, what have we done? Knowing full well that's going to be a really hard ask.
Hello, my name is Dusty Rhodes and you're welcome to Amplify, the Engineers Journal podcast. I think we can agree that Irish engineers are incredibly creative thinkers and innovators, but it's a big leap going from innovator to entrepreneur and taking an idea you might have to market. In this episode, we'll be hearing from a prominent engineer with a fascinating career history, which took her from aeronautical engineering into the biomedical space. We'll be finding out how she looks at problems, overcomes obstacles, where she sees innovation and opportunity, and getting some great advice for any engineers who are thinking of launching their own business. It's a pleasure to welcome the CEO of Ultratech and the Assistant Director of the Stokes Research Institute at UL, Dr. Tara Dalton. Tara, how are you?
Hi, how are you? I am good. Thank you so much.
Listen, welcome out onto the podcast. I always start off by asking people, what made you want to be an engineer? How did you get into this game at all?
Actually, I think to be quite truthful, I think it was my father. I had all sorts of different plans. And I remember not really wanting to do honors maths at school. And my father sort of saying, it opens up such a lot for you. So, he worked in the University of Limerick and he felt that engineering was a really good combination of creativity and of maths, because I always did like the sciences. I was interested in physics and chemistry and biology. So I think in some senses it was serendipitous because I suppose it was my dad who really kind of pushed me to taking that on.
So when you went through school and university, you got into engineering then proper and you started with aeronautical engineering. Tell me a bit more about that.
So actually, I started with mechanical and then they launched aeronautical engineering when I was in third year. So at that time, it wasn't a discipline in itself. It was something you could specialize in third year. I think I was just so completely fascinated because I think it goes against every instinct in our body that we can put that thing up in the sky. every instinct and every single time I think about something that can't be done, I look at it and say, they have an engine there that is going at, 15,000 RPM. That's huge. Up at 36,000 feet. Come on. Like, of course we can do it. So I think it's just fascinating in almost a romantic way. And I still love it. I changed because in some senses, there's a lot more, I think, innovation in biomedical engineering. The aeronautical engineering is quite a regulated space. So, for me, it didn't allow that creativity and that innovation. So I changed to biomedical engineering, but aeronautical engineering still has a huge, soft spot. I still love airplanes. I love flying them. I love watching them. So,
There's a real passion there for you for aeronautical and flying. But you went from that then into biomedical. Why did you make the switch?
Well, so I did a postdoc in the University of Limerick. And at the time, the government had this really amazing program. It was called the Programs in Advanced Technology, PAT programs. And basically what they encouraged you to do was as a postdoc, they encouraged you to work hugely with industry. And then they supported that intervention. So they wanted to link university researchers with industry. And we were fortunate. We had a great kind of PAT group. And we worked with Intel. We worked with Hewlett Packard. We worked with, Nokia at the time. And I just got this feeling. I loved it. I loved that idea that what you did had an impact, even if it is in a large multinational or a small company. Commensurate with that, around the same time, the Science Foundation Ireland was set up. And at that time, they'd a remit to fund two big things. So ICT at the time and bio. And that was their decision. So I thought, okay, let's be real here. If you want to get research money, you have to be like Wayne Gretzky, the great ice skater. He says, skate where the puck is going to be, not where the puck has been. You know what I mean? So, you've got to look at the landscape and say, well, that's where the research money is going to be. If you think about at the time, bio, the genome had just been sequenced. This was the biggest thing ever. it was a breakthrough for PCR reactions and everything. So when you looked at it, you think, okay, there's going to be so much scope for an engineer following breaking science. In my mind, an engineer, you don't want to be at the cutting edge of absolute new science, but as an engineer, you just want to be just behind it so you can help to, you know, help people with that science. So for me, you know, as I said, the genome had just been sequenced. I could see for the next 15 years, you know, there's going to be massive innovation in this space, which there was. So that's why I changed from sort of aeromechanical to much more biofocused. But it is really applying the same principles of any engineer, just to a different class of problems, if you like.
Listening to you talking about kind of biomedical, I mean, you're very passionate about it, but I kind of get the impression that are you more passionate about the fact that you're doing something challenging and something new and something that's going to help people rather than it being actually to do with aeronautical or biomedical?
Yeah, I think so. As I said, the same principles are applied, you know, the same engineering principles are applied to everything. But I think in biomedical engineering, well, first of all, it's very interdisciplinary. So you get to learn from, you know, loads of people. And it's full of problems to be solved, which is great. You know, there's loads of things that we don't know that we want to solve. And so for me, it's like, you know, it's like a child in a sweet shop. You know, there's just so many interesting things to learn. And I love learning. There's just so much. And the other thing is, when you work with interdisciplinary people, and I worked with medics, with physicists, with chemists, with entrepreneurs, with finance people, it's just amazing, because I find that everybody wants to help you be better. Nobody, at least in my experience, kind of gatekeeps their knowledge. And I think in when you're in that place where you really want to try and solve a problem, I find that people don't gatekeep the knowledge because they want to find solutions. And so it's an extraordinary place to be. And also, I think I'm not a person, some people I think are really good, and you see people who kind of take a problem and they dive into it and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. I'm not that kind of person. I like to kind of spread out, you know what I mean? So look at, you know, applying this skill from over here, from over here, from over here, rather than doing kind of this classical deep dive and understanding a problem more. Absolutely, that's important as well. That's just not me. So I think this type of problem solving engineering suits me more than, we'll say, a classic scientist, you know, where you're really building on knowledge and really getting a deep, deep understanding about that. I'm kind of more, okay, how do we solve a problem? So I think that's the difference between engineering. Well, in my opinion, the difference between engineering and sort of deep science, if you like.
Well, I think that's what we do, is, you know, we look at problems and we go, well, how can we fix this, or how can we make it better? Now, a lot of people who will be working as engineers or within a company, and they have all these thoughts and ideas, but sometimes, you know, things don't happen because there's a boss upstairs or the company doesn't want to go that way. You're different in that you kind of went, well, I really want to do this, so I'm going to be an entrepreneur and I'm going to start my own business. Do you think that your engineering brain and the way that it works kind of helped you to stand on your own two feet and run your own business?
I think my experience when I did the programs at PAT, so we ended up interacting with companies an awful lot. And I think that stood to me. And also, the idea that something that you created, that somebody actually bought, I mean, they paid money. I remember my father-in-law saying to me that money is stored work. You know what I mean? And so, you know, this idea that somebody is going to pay for that, I thought that's a brilliant idea. And I always wanted to do it. I always wanted to do it since I was sort of 26, 27. And in a, you know, whatever about a company, in a university environment, you know, things are changing and have changed. But at that time, there is a lot of pressure put, you know, on publications, and this is what we do. And, you know, to go and say, okay, I'm going to create a company. It's not necessary. Now, University of Limerick, I have to say, were brilliant. But, you know, there are people who say, okay, look, that isn't the job of an academic. But I think as an academic engineer, it is exactly my job. Even if it's not to create enterprise, to help enterprise and to work on sort of, you know, engineering problems. So I always wanted to do that. And I think, you know, naivety is your friend in doing this. It really is, because, you know, in some senses, Ultratech is my second, or it's actually technically it's my fourth company. I did one bit that failed for very funny reasons.
Tell me.
Oh yeah, this is hilarious. So like the first we had this amazing product. Well, in my view it was, right? It was a fiber optic based system that actually was used to turn on heaters to take ice off helicopter blades. You need to, when helicopters, obviously ice forming on helicopter blades is really, really bad. And depending on the type of ice, anyway, it was a piece of hardware. And for some reason, I got picked to go to Boston. Now, this is, I was like 28 or something, to pitch my idea in front of Hambrecht & Quist, which would have been a lawyer firm, but with a lot of VC backing, a lot of companies. Now, there was a lot of potential companies going to do that. So I remember sitting there and I had my little piece of hardware and I had my sheet with all this details on it. And I was listening to everybody present and every single one of them was software companies. This was the dot-com thing. And some of them were the most stupidest ideas you could ever imagine. But that wasn't the point. The point was, is they were getting funding. These people were looking for 1.5 million, 2 million. And I learned straight away, okay, again, that was skate where the puck is, right? So it didn't matter. I had this great product, but to get venture capital funding, that was never going to happen because it wasn't in that ecosystem at the time. So that was one really big learning lesson. And again, similarly, the second company that we did, actually did work, but it wasn't a high potential startup. So that was one of the reasons I changed to bio, because you are basically in VCs, they like to fund what other people fund, so you're thinking, okay, I need to be in that area. Stokes Bio was then the third company. And so we learned, okay, look, this is what we're going to do. We're going to follow breaking science. We're going to use our own skills. And we're really careful about how we kind of positioned what we did. And of course, a lot of people said, we're engineers in the biosciences. You haven't to hope in hell. And again, you just ignore it. You know what I mean? And I think you ignore it because you have so much fun doing it. It doesn't really matter. You know what I mean? You're just really enjoying learning, and we had loads of PhD students and, we brilliant collaborators. And, to use that horrible word, but the journey that was as important as the exit and the final part of it.
But it is the journey, as you say. And what I love about what you're talking about, it's kind of like you've given us two examples where you fell down. There's nothing wrong with falling down. It's how you pick yourself up afterwards, okay? So you fell down once, you fell down twice, you picked yourself up once, you picked yourself up twice. You went into the third one. Now, the third one was quite successful. And this is kind of, you're very well known for Stokes was, you mentioned it. It's been a big part of your life because that kind of straddles a commercial company and a university. And I don't understand how that works. So tell me about it.
Okay, so So it's myself and my co-founder, Professor Mark Davies. So he was actually my PhD supervisor. And then, we kind of drifted apart and then we came back together to do this. And again, the genome was in sequence and we were really fascinated with that. So we started a research group in the university. And the advantage of starting your research in the university is it's a very gentle pace to explore ideas so that you're not giving away equity if you make mistakes, or it's taking time that, for a long time it wasn't, the stuff we were doing wasn't working. And in a university environment, that can be tolerated a lot easier. And we had a number of PhD students. And interestingly, so we went to the SFI five times for funding, and ETHBI wouldn't fund what we were doing. And look, that's okay. I get it. We didn't have a history in what we were doing. And at the time, reviewers would say, look, this isn't really that novel, etc. But engineering isn't supposed to be that hugely novel. It's supposed to take science and if you take if you take a hero experiment that's done once, you want to engineer it so you could do it 100 million times, So that's kind of where we were coming at. And I get why SFI, but anyway, at that time I was like, oh my God, how are we going to get funding? What are we going to do? Now, Enterprise Ireland were really supportive of what we were doing and they funded us. And I thought, okay, what we'll do? We'll do some publicity. So we did some publicity and I contacted a publicist and I said, listen, I think what we're doing is really kind of clever and interesting. Could we get some traction? Just even on the Irish stage, not necessarily European or American. So it was caught by the Irish Times, actually. And a VC saw it. And he approached us and he said, when you spin this company out, can we be at the table? We'll give you €100,000 if we're at the table. And I said, look, let's forget that. Let's just do it now. You know, I was so anxious. And, you know, in some senses, would I said we were a bit early? Probably. That's true. So the University of Limerick and us and the VC did a deal for our intellectual property. We did a deal for, we had a whole bunch of students. And we moved the company out of the university. And I wanted it out of the university because I wanted a real separation between what we did in UL and what, you know, the commercial aspect of what we were doing. And like the university, as I said, they were amazing. They allowed me, myself and Mark, to remain as academics, okay, full-time academics, and to do the company. And that took a lot of creative thinking, but we did it. They assigned us our intellectual property, which means our intellectual property was owned by the company, not licensed. And I know that that isn't done now, but it was such a really good thing for the company. It gave us huge freedoms later on in raising money, and in doing strategic relationships. So, you know, I know that's not done nowadays, but it was great. So we ended up taking all our PhD students into the company eventually as they started to graduate. So we had this, well, what's the word I'm looking for? A conveyor belt of amazing, amazing people that we took into the company. And yeah, but, you know, don't get me wrong. It was hard because, you know, we were new at this, new at managing VCs, new at that relationships, new at raising money. And then finally we got a strategic, you know, finally the deal, the exit happened, and that was great. But it was tough, but fun, you know.
It's fascinating listening to you taking on this problem of having an idea and wanting to run a company to implement that idea and the reasons why you did it. And it didn't work the first time, it didn't work the second time, the third time it did work, and you had good partners and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Eventually you had to sell it, which is always, you know, kind of heartbreaking. Yeah. Did you make much?
Yeah, we did okay. So yeah, so we did
okay. Put a number on it, Tara.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So we ended up selling. So we raised about sort of maybe 6-7 million, and then we sold it for almost $50 million, which was a really nice return for everybody because the company had a really nice simple cap table. It wasn't hugely dilutive, so you know it was good. It was good in that regard. So I think everybody did well.
Well, all I could do, I'm literally standing up and applauding.
No, good on you.
Fair play, okay? Because it's brilliant, because you followed that through and you worked on all of the problems and you had some success, okay? So, I mean, that was great. And it was, what, 2010 you sold there, somewhere around
there,
was it?
Then myself and Mark went to work for the company, the acquirers were Life Technologies at Thermo Fisher now. So we took then a 2-year leave of absence to work with the integration of the technology into which was, again, I got to work with a multinational for 2 years, which was really exciting. And that was, you know, that was really different. And, you know, I teach my students, we do med devices and we do like a dragon's den. So I teach them, you know, and one of the things, this exact same thing you do with selling an idea to a VC, you'd sell an idea to your bosses in a multinational. It's the same thing, it's the same ideas. And so we had that experience as well of kind of integrating what we were doing into a US multinational, which was different. That's for certain, yeah.
So as well as teaching and inspiring people in University of Limerick still, you're also the CEO of Ultratech, as I mentioned in the intro. Now, you're leading a team of over 20 engineers and scientists there. To a layman like myself, can you describe what it is that you're working on?
Okay, so Ultratech, I'm not a founder of Ultratech. There are two founders. And one of the founders I knew because he founded his previous company the same time I founded Stokes Bio. And he was in the university as well. So, and we were funded by the same venture capitalist. So we kind of knew each other. And then, you know, we kind of both, he sold his company successfully, I sold mine. And then we kind of got together and he said he had this idea of, so he's a silicon designer, he's an electronics engineer. And he said, oh, you know, could I do something with silicon in the biospace? And I was like, you know, it's really interesting you say that because there's been this huge explosion. So I know that Life Technologies bought a sequencing company for silicon. I think they bought it for up north of 600 million. Okay, so it was a huge acquisition. And there were some other companies. There was Nanopore. There was a few. And I said, do you know something, Tim? I said, yeah, you know, there's an idea there. So he went away and he kind of thought about it. And then Niall, the venture capitalist, said, you know, Tara, you know this space. Because, you know, I'd been in that kind of bio space, et cetera. And he said, you know, would you be on the board? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. Because I'd been back in the university for a while. I was doing some work on cancer stuff and stuff on heterogeneity of tumors. And I was like, oh, I'm kind of feeling the itch again now to do something outside of that. And so I said, yeah, I'll be on the board. And then a week later, he goes, Tara, would you CEO it? And I was like, are you kidding me? I was like, oh gosh, no. And I said it to my husband. I was like, Jeff, I said, oh God. And he says, Tara, you have to. Like, so I was like, okay, I'll do it. And so basically what it is, it's really compelling science and it's so interdisciplinary. It's basically a methodology or a product that can detect any virus in a non-clinical setting. Very importantly, it doesn't use an enzymatic step. So you would be aware, okay, everybody listening to this would be aware of PCR. If I was to tell everybody this like 3-4 years ago pre-COVID, they'd look at me blankly. But now kind of people get it, right? So you know what PCR is. You know how the importance of it and how, because it's such an accurate technique for detecting any virus from COVID to flu to, you know, to HIV, it doesn't matter. But the trouble with PCR is it's a technique that you can't really take outside the laboratory or the clinical setting. And so we've invented a way that can do that. And it uses a combination of, you know, really novel chemistry, biology, and microfluidics, which is kind of my area, and silicon chip design. So it's really difficult. And, it's been tough. You know, the technological development is tough. But if it wasn't tough, it's not going to be worth it, right? Because you'll say, well, then, it is tough because it is so groundbreaking and so it's going to change the world, in my view, for viral detection, in my view. But it is technically challenging.
You've mentioned several times that you're always thinking about where the puck is going to be rather than where it is now. And when you talk about Ultratech, I mean, that was mid-20 teens, whatever, you got involved in that, was it?
Yeah, 15, yeah, 16, yeah, 70, yeah. Somewhere. Just prior to COVID.
Well, that's exactly my point, right? Is because you got involved in this and then COVID came along and boom, your company is perfectly.
Yeah, it's so funny because we had a video. We had to do in 2019 or just before COVID in November, we had to do a presentation in Boston and part of you to make a video of what your technology does. And literally we had on the video, this would be, suitable for pandemic management and et cetera. And that, and Marta came out. The difficulty was our technology was too early for it. You know what I mean? Like, and when you get a crisis situation like that, what happens is you reposition old technology because that's what you have to do. You don't really have the time to invent something new. But what a crisis does is you reposition old technology, but then what it does is it makes people aware that, oh my gosh, there's a need there. You know, there is a need for us to be able to manage pandemics in a much better way than obviously than what's happened. And there's going to be technologies that are going to enable that. Whether we get there, whether we were in the race, I don't know, but we're definitely in with a chance.
I absolutely love how your brain works because seriously, because you think research, development, innovation is very much key to you. You're kind of always thinking about the future, but you always seem to spot a gap in the market. And what I want to ask you is, do you even know in your own brain how you are able to spot a gap in a market? How do you weigh things up when you're looking at opportunities?
Well, first of all, I don't know whether I am or not. You know what I mean? I think that would remain to be seen. But anyway, I think it's because that's the broadness. It's just not the deep dive person. Like, it's looking around you. So I just got in funding now for my next company, which after Ultratech, and, we're just doing the early research now in the university, and it's on the immune system, it's on immunotherapies. And, if I was to ask you, you'd say, oh yeah, okay, you get that. Because, if you were to pick up the newspaper 10 years ago, you wouldn't read about immunotherapies. You wouldn't think about it. Now we know, think about like the immune system, autoimmune diseases, allergies, our understanding about how we react to vaccines immunotherapies for cancer. You know, that's exploded in the last 10 years. So again, we're going to need engineering behind that technology, you know, behind that science to support the growth in that area. So that's, you know, it's just kind of watching and thinking, ah, yeah, that's new. It's breaking science, really, is what you want to keep an eye on. For me, that's what I keep an eye on.
And then when you see something that you think has potential, you look into it a little bit further, and then if you feel really good about it.
You know, the virus thing, I mean, that's kind of obvious. If you think about it, all the outbreaks that we've had, you know, SARS, you know, all that, you just know, and you know it was going to happen. We knew it was going to happen. It was not a question of if it was, it was a question of when, okay? I mean, you know, that's 100%. I mean, everything from the Spanish flu, guys, you know, it's just a matter of when. And we were lucky this time.
Why are you so confident when you say that COVID was, it was a matter of when, not if?
Because there's always outbreaks. There's always outbreaks. And all you need is the right conditions. So if you take something like, if you take a virus that kills people quickly, then it's probably not going to spread much. If you get something that spreads a lot, it's probably not going to. And so all you need to do is just get that balance right where it, you know, spreads quickly and it has a potentially devastating effect. That's going to happen again. Of course it is. You know, and if you think about it, you know, how the world has changed, global travel, our interaction, where something may have been contained. You know, I remember saying to somebody, you know, 5 years ago, I said, we will listen, somebody will use the word quarantine in our lifetimes and we'll hear the word quarantine again. You know, you were probably growing up. Did you ever hear the word quarantine? In the 50s, you would have heard it, you know, when people had scarlet fever, when people had people quarantined. Now it's, you know, obviously we tried it. It's, you know, it's not really feasible. It's, you know, so we need other ways of managing when these things happen. And it's going to be a combination of understanding and technology, in my view. So
I think anybody in listening, I mean, I have my own ideas, my own radio and broadcasting and podcasting business about where it's going to be in 10 years time. There's engineers listening to it and they're going, my God, she's right, because I know that in 10 years time, boom, it's going to be a problem, or this is going to happen again, or whatever it happens to be. If somebody is listening to you and they have a big innovative idea in their head, but they just don't know how to move forward, what would your advice to them be?
Oh, I think it depends where they are, you know, where they are in their, where they're physically working as well, and what opportunities they have. You know, obviously, if somebody is in a university, they're, you know, that's the ecosystem I understand, so I can, you know, very easily direct them. If somebody is in a multinational company or somebody is not, I would have less understanding about how they would go about, you know, about doing that. I think, regardless, ask for help. Everybody, ask for help. Go talk to people. Go talk to Enterprise Ireland. Go talk to lawyers. Go talk to VCs. Ask, and don't go say, I want. Just say, what should I do? How could you help me? What can I do? And you'd be surprised how many people will give you their time. And you'd be surprised at it, in my view. You know, we have top lawyers in Boston who did stuff for us pro bono because they just think, oh yeah, this is really cool. We'll do that. And look, we'll make our money later on when they're successful. You know, there's a lot of people who will do that for you. So talk, go out there and share your idea.
I love the fact that I'm speaking to a lady who has sold a company for $50 million and says that ask for help because it's what you did and people were willing to step up. Isn't it amazing how humankind is?
And even now, no matter what you do, if people come to me or I still go to people and say, okay, you know, I need help here or I'm not sure. People who worked for me before in Stokes Bio now work for me in Altratec or work with me in Altratec. And you know, you start to build that community. And it's true, I will call like an ex-PhD student or somebody I know and say, crikey, I need help on that. Or they can call me and say, Tara, you know, do you remember that? You wouldn't give me an hour of your time. And it's like, yeah, of course. You know what I mean? And I, you know, I love it. So, and people do love being asked for help.
That's brilliant advice. And I can't overstate it so much how good that advice is. And my own experience, I know that to be true. The other thing that I want to ask you about, Tara, is your approach to problem solving. And again, thinking of an engineer's thing, I've got a brilliant idea and I want to go, but it's too much. Oh my God. How do you know, kind of, I have to get over this a humongously big wall, which I don't know how to get over. How am I going to do it? You're a good problem solver. What way do you break down that problem?
Well, actually, interestingly, so I'm a bit more the way you just like, oh my God, oh my God, oh bloody hell, what have I done? Like, what have I done? I'm more like that. It's like, Jem, my husband, he said, like, what scrape have you gotten into today? And I was like, yeah, I know. And it's like, and he would say, okay, you know, what can you do tomorrow? You know, stop borrowing trouble. It's got too much interest. Do you know what I mean? Just, what can you do? And the person I worked, Davies, who I worked with as well, he was really good. He never flapped. He never let perfection hinder progress. And so I just say, okay, let's just make progress. And really, I have to be consciously aware of thinking, oh God, you know what I mean? What have we committed to? We signed a contract to do something. Like, what have we done? Knowing full well, that's going to be a really hard ask. And then you think, okay, look, let's just put the head down and don't think about it. You know what I mean? Literally just say, okay, let's not have that hinder the small progresses. You know what I mean? So yeah, but I would be more the way you described it than I would be, you know, going, oh, sure, this is fine.
Do you know what I've written down on a sheet of paper here? Never let perfection hinder progress. I'm going to type that up and I'm going to stick it on the wall. It's going to stay there for 6 months.
Yeah, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? Or just get on with it, you know what I mean? Rather than, you know, because you can get this, you know, if you see this huge problem, it's like, you just grab it in the headlights. You just look at it and go, you feel paralyzed. And then you just got to go, okay, no. And also I think having people around you that you can say that to. There's a guy I love listening to. It's Simon Sinek, but he has this 8-minute rule. And he says, like, you should have a team around you that, you know, for 8 minutes you can rant. And that they're not in, you know, sometimes you don't want somebody in solution space. You just want somebody to listen to you go like, oh my God, this is terrible. This is not going to work. What's going to happen? Da, 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 da. And you give yourself 8 minutes, that's it. And then it's over. You know what I mean? So I think you have to allow yourself that feeling and then say, okay, push it away now. Let's get on with it. You know, so.
Tara, I have to say, like, listening to you and just chatting, because I have a bit of an entrepreneurial spirit in me, and I like to call myself a sound engineer. That's how I get away with presenting this particular thing. But like many engineers, I see problems and I want to fix them and I want to make the world better. And I think that, you know, your success is amazing. And after listening to you for the last little while, you're now a god in my world. Okay. But this is it. Okay. What I wanted to ask you was, people who are listening now who are inspired by you, what would you say to someone who's listening to us right now who does think you're an inspiration? Are you God? Are you a normal person?
I'm an engineer. I'm a normal engineer. I mean, I'm just a normal engineer. Like, there's loads of us out there who do, you know, who do all this, who solve all these problems all the time, you know, and there's ones that are a zillion, million times. Like Jeff, my husband, is a much better engineer than me. Like, I'm always going to him with solving problems, you know. Mark is much better. I think I would say choose your problem wisely. Often, in my mind, for an engineer, they're often too focused on solutions, right? You're solving problems. But if you want to sort of have impact, do that. Spend time choosing your problem. Like when we were doing Stokes Bio, like Mark and I spent 2 years in America watching what people were doing and figuring out that landscape. So don't be afraid of taking time to figure that problem out. You know what I mean? The solution, anybody can do that. To be honest with you, like a lot of people, if you give them a problem, and you set the boundary conditions on that problem. And you say, okay, look, this is the kind of area that most people worth their salt can do that. I think the cleverness, in my view, and is choosing the correct problem at the right time. So that's what I would say. Spend time doing that and talking and socializing it and thinking of it and testing it and arguing it. And that's why it's great to work with people, because you get all that feedback. You know, it's like, if I say to you, look, I'm thinking of doing something there. And you're like, really? why? Or so-and-so is doing that. Or what's your angle? Or, you know, I mean, don't be afraid to just let that argument be battered around a bit. And it'll form much better out of it. Sorry, I talk way too much. Apologies.
Listen, I could listen to you all day. Tara, I think what I was trying to get across was that what's inside of you and what's driven your success is inside all of us. It's an engineering trait. And I just think listening to you and, as I say, being inspired by what you're saying, we can go off and we can just make our own lives a little bit better. So I just wanted to thank you very much for sharing with us today. Dr. Tara Dalton, CEO of Altatech and Assistant Director of the Stokes Research Institute, UL. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
If you would like to find out more about Tara and some of the topics which we spoke about today, you'll find notes and link details in the description area of this podcast right now. Also, if you enjoyed our podcast today, do share with a friend in the business. Just tell them to search for Engineers Ireland in their podcast player. Our podcast is produced by dustpod.io for Engineers Ireland. For advanced episodes, more information on engineering across Ireland or career development opportunities, there are libraries of information on our website at engineersireland.ie. Until next time, from myself, Dusty Rhodes, as always, thank you for listening.